So a couple of years back, and for reasons that don't bear mentioning from the pulpit, I found myself taking one of the state-mandated defensive driver courses. And it was a blast. For those of you who have never had this experience, and certainly none of you have ever had this experience, let me describe how it works. The online course is self-paced, but it is timed and gated to ensure that it takes no less than 3 hours. It consists of several training videos interspersed with review questions to make sure that you have been paying attention. And then at the end of the class, you are given the opportunity for a practice exam and then to take a real exam consisting of 40 multiple choice questions, all of which are very similar to the practice exam and which are, in turn, very similar to the review questions at the end of each section. In order to pass and receive credit for having taken the class, one must achieve a score of 80%. That is 32 out of 40 questions answered correctly. Now, I don't mean to be cocky. I, in fact, was the one that was in the defensive driving course. But I, like most clerics in our tradition, am pretty well educated. Or at least, I spent the vast majority of my first 30 years of life in school taking tests. So needless to say, I was not concerned about the academic rigor of this 3-hour course. At the end of each section, I breezed through the review questions with time to spare, enough time, mind you, to make several loaves of homemade sourdough while the video components were playing in the background. Yeah, you all know what's coming. At the end of the entire session, I opted to take the practice exam out of a sense of insurance, I guess. And I scored a perfect 40 out of 40. Couldn't wait for the real test and my future as a certified defensive driver in the state of Texas. The final took no time at all, and my score? Well, we'll talk about that a little bit later. This morning's readings function somewhat the same as that state-mandated defensive driving test. If not in our lives, because, you know, none of us need to brush up on the gospel, then at least in the lives of those who heard them the first time. It had been a long time since they had heard the gospel of grace. Mistakes were being made. Or maybe folks were just looking to reduce the cost of their monthly insurance, right? It's never about the ticket, it's always about the insurance. But I digress. It's time for a refresher course, and Paul and Luke are ready to help us out with that. Paul provides the lecture, the written portion of the online experience, if you will. The whole of the last several weeks of Galatians readings have been that lecture. And today we get something of the video. The true gospel, the gospel of Jesus Christ, the gospel of freedom, has been Paul's message. That's the easy part. The more nuanced part is the question, the freedom to what? The freedom to do as we choose? The freedom to oppress who we want? The freedom to act according to our nature, regardless of what it does to others? The freedom to interpret that 35-mile-hour sign as just a suggestion because you need to get to a diocesan meeting? Certainly not. The freedom that the gospel provides is a freedom from the chains of slavery and sin and self-interest. The gospel of freedom is the freedom to act in the benefit of others without worrying about whether or not self-deprecation is eternally costly. Now on to the videos and examples, or in this case, the metaphors. The gospel of slavery yields the works of the flesh, St. Paul says. Now the works of the flesh are obvious: fornication, impurity, licentiousness, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, anger, quarrels, dissensions, factions, envy, drunkenness, carousing, and other things like this. If you don't know the power of these things in your own life, then you certainly know the power of them in your community. These are anti-freedom. They are at their root anti-community and ultimately self-serving. And oh, Paul adds, be careful that as you try to devour others, you don't get devoured yourself. It seems to be a vicious cycle and a pattern. Now, the gospel of Jesus, on the other hand, the gospel of freedom, the true gospel, as Paul talks, is by contrast based on the fruits of the Spirit. And the fruits of the Spirit is love, joy and peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against these things, Paul adds, there is no law. For they are in themselves not self-satisfying. They are not self-seeking. They are community building. Got it? Now we can spend a little bit more time if you'd like, but you look like you're ready. Okay? So here's the pretest. According to the gospel, according to St. Luke, we are provided with a worthy word problem. Jesus has set his eyes towards Jerusalem. That means he's come into his own and is shifting the mode of his ministry from gospel proclamation to gospel action. His disciples have heard the message of the gospel, and it's time for them to act too. So hot on the heels of the interaction with the Gerasene demoniac, the disciples are sent ahead of Jesus into a village of the Samaritans. Initially, they accept the message of Jesus, but later they reject him. What does a faithful disciple do? Multiple choice. A, gripe and complain softly in the background. B, follow Jesus as he continues on his way. Or C, call down fire. C, right? No. Wrong answer. Jesus rebukes the disciples for condemning those who initially accept the gospel and later reject it. Of course he does. What else is he going to do? What part of freedom to accept and embrace all people did they fail to understand? Good thing this was just the pretest, right? Jesus' pointed response here seems almost as hyperbolic as the disciples' blunder. Of course we're not going to firebomb those who accept Jesus and then reject him. That would be a fleshly response, to borrow words from St. Paul. Even though it might be permissible under the law, I'd have to check on that. It would still be coming from a place of anger, of rage, of enmity, of strife, and it would ultimately be supporting our own self-preservation and sense of self-justification. This is why Jesus does not want us to firebomb our enemies. The right answer? We do what Jesus did and keep moving, your face set towards Jerusalem. All right, ready for the final? Okay, now the state says that you have to get a score of 80%. This exam has three questions, which means you would have to get them all right. So, I'll be more lenient. Seeing as I did miss one on the final of that defensive driving exam, I know, strange, particularly since I did so well on the practice test, I'll say you can pass if you only miss one of the three. 66%, sound like a deal? Question one. You are a disciple of Jesus, and someone, a stranger, runs up to him and says, Lord, I will follow you. Do you, A, call down fire from heaven? B, ask for their credentials and bona fides? Or C, remind them of the cost of discipleship and say little else? How many chose A, call down fire? Good deal. Good. That's obviously not the answer. And neither is B. Now, to me, C, that is, remind them of the cost of discipleship and keep moving, doesn't seem exactly right either. But that's the one that Jesus did. So it must be right. That's good test-taking logic, right? So let's keep that one in mind and move forward. Question two. Jesus is talking with another potential follower and says to him, "Follow me." The potential follower does not obey immediately, but makes an excuse about why today is a less than optimal day to begin his or her discipleship. What do you do? Do you A, call down fire from heaven? B, remind them of the cost of discipleship and then go on your way? Or C, make a cryptic yet pointed retort about the spiritual status of those who stick around to bury the dead? Now, I know we know that A is not the answer, but let's be honest. How many of us were tempted to call down fire this time? I mean, seriously, turn down an invitation from Jesus? How dare they? I won't belabor the point, but I hope you can see in this example the pervasiveness of fleshly thinking and why the disciples might not always be as silly as we want them to be. Maybe you were one that was thinking we ought to call down fire on the disciples. Now, B seemed like a good answer, didn't it? It's what Jesus did last time, but I wonder why it's wrong, too. Well, because C is the correct answer. Again, because it's what Jesus did. But I'll confess to you, friends, that I'm even more stumped by this one than I was by the previous one. It's kind of like why the person to the right gets to make a turn. All right, last question. Everybody still poised for success? Has everyone gotten at least one right? Nobody's missed the first two and need to repeat the course. Okay, so high stakes. Last one. Ready to go? Here we go. Question 3. Another person comes to Jesus and asks to follow him. Good start. But then includes an even lamer excuse about why he'll need to delay. What do you do? A, make a cryptic statement about the spiritual status of living relatives. B, make a pointed statement about the worthiness of backsliders and procrastinators. Or C, call down fire from heaven. Okay, so that time, I can see on your faces, we really wanted to call down fire. What was this guy thinking? Say goodbye to your parents rather than follow Jesus? What was he, 13 or something? Well, probably, but that's beside the point. Honestly, though, I don't see a lot of difference between that and the correct answer. It seems that Jesus is trying to shame this potential disciple into following him, and again, I'm not sure I understand. Well, I hope that you all did all right with our tests. I hope that you all feel well equipped for your continued life as followers of Jesus Christ. But I think we do need to dig a little deeper into these three seemingly strange answers. If the gospel of freedom is a gospel to follow Jesus as we choose, then why is Jesus ignoring one group and chastising another and then just saying strange things about dead people burying dead people to the third? Even at the end of this test, are we still clearly understanding what the nature of the gospel of freedom is all about? Paul says, "For freedom we are set free." We are set free for sure from self-interest and from slavery and from oppression by others who would lock us into one way of believing or another, but we still are wrestling with the question, what are we now free to do? The too simple answer is to say we are free to self-interest. The equally too simple answer is to say we are free to love. Without any further exploration of what that really means. The gospel of freedom is not simply that freedom from doing what other people say or the ability to do what we say ourselves. It is, as Paul is very clear, the freedom to follow the will of God. That is, in Luke's language, to set our face towards Jerusalem and all that that means for us. Yes, we can choose any path that we want to, but the path that leads to salvation is set out before us. It lies in the direction of Jerusalem, and our freedom is to do that will of God. To be free, as it were, even from ourselves. The freedom of Jesus Christ is the freedom to speak the truth. Yes, when it's convenient. Yes, when it is to power. But yes, also when it is hard to hear. The man who comes to Jesus grieving, who Jesus invites to follow, does not want to hear that the dead are burying their own dead, but it's what he needs. Go and proclaim the gospel, Jesus says. Do the will of God and set your face towards Jerusalem. And finally, the freedom of Jesus Christ is the freedom to love. Not a love of easy answers or coddling or justifying the other, but to borrow the language of St. Augustine, the will and to work for the salvation of others. Even when it means pointing out their faults. Even when it may cost us everything, including our own sense of freedom. Amen.